This Edgar Profiles podcast is supported by Ping. Edgar is an association of national federations formed in the year 2000 to develop and encourage initiatives which raise the awareness of golf, both as a participation and competitive sport for individuals with disability. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Your host for this episode is Tony Bennett. Ping. Play your best.
I'm Tony Bennett. Before I start, I would like to tell you a short, personal, and true story about Ping.
From the age of 13, when John Solheim's club building apprenticeship started in their Californian garage, he learned countless lessons about business and life from his father, Carsten Solheim. As the company graduated from putters to irons and woods, Carsten would decide whether a concept went forward by asking, "Does it make the ball go straighter?" The clubs Ping were making did perform better, and from our original small operation, we were transforming club design and manufacturing. Carsten Solheim revolutionized the modern golf club, and he set high standards for design and quality that other club makers had to follow if they wanted to compete. Carsten did this by constantly challenging himself and all employees to push their thinking and keep evolving in pursuit of the highest quality, best performing products possible. The imprint he left on the industry in so many areas helped establish Carsten as a widely respected and beloved visionary. He was a recipient of many accolades and awards, and he is the only golf club manufacturer in the World Golf Hall of Fame.
One in every five people who listen to this story will from time to time carry a germ at the back of their throat. That is, in the words of my guest, super rare and deadly. Fortunately, in developed countries, few people are struck down by the disease, which acts fast and is life-threatening. My guest, Mike Rowles, is one of a few. At 18 years of age, Mike, who loves his sport, found himself in a sprint. This race against time had high stakes. His opponent, meningococcal septicemia. It acts fast and can take limbs, cause organ failure and bleeding of the brain. By the time he was diagnosed, the disease was firmly in the lead, and Mike, with just a 5% chance of survival, just had to cling on. With the support of his family, Mike turned the corner, and the sprint became a marathon, one that would take painstaking steps to make a recovery. In my conversation with Mike, he tells me of how he has dealt with the legacy of surviving his battle with meningococcal septicemia, how he has developed his communication skills, and why he is committed to sharing his story. Mike talks about the amazing friendships he has formed with other amputees, his return to golf, and relearning to play the game, not once, but twice, and what golf means to him. Mike is hugely engaging as he walks me step by step through his story, and with every step I learn something new. I hope you find this journey as irresistible as I did. Hi Mike, it's great to get together with you today. I know that you're in a very sunny Melbourne, and I think it's around 5:30 in the evening there.
Yeah.
And it's 6:30 in the morning for me, so early start. Mike, you were born and raised in such a great city, which is famous for its sport, especially tennis, and of course it's home to the Australian Open. But there are many other things in Melbourne. Tell me, what sports did you play, Mike?
I was born and raised in Melbourne, up at the Mercy Hospital. I was born and grew up in Sandringham, which is only around about 30 to 40 minutes southeast of Melbourne, just a short drive. And it was such a wonderful place to grow up, plenty of opportunities for sport. And I dived into just about everything I possibly could. A lot of it was contact sport. I just absolutely loved football. I played soccer for a few years, but golf was always something that I did right from when I was a young fella. My dad actually, he had a couple of golf clubs made where he cut a driver in half and turned it into an 8-iron and a 6-iron.
Right.
And then I was, as a little four or five-year-old, I'd go out the back and hit balls around the park and things like that, and often get told off by the neighbours for playing golf, but it didn't really deter me. But golf was probably not something that I focused too heavily on. It was more the team sports that I really loved. Football was probably my main sport that I got involved in. And I guess tennis is something that I deal a little bit of, not competitively, but just anything. I just love to be outdoors, love to be kicking a football, running around, exercising, and I was certainly a kid with plenty of energy.
And you mentioned contact sports there, so did you play any of that Aussie rules football? Because that seemed like a pretty tough game.
When I say football, I mean Aussie rules. So in our country, in Australia, we call football soccer. I know you guys call it football, but everyone refers to it as soccer. And footy, when I say football, I certainly don't mean rugby. I mean AFL, Australian rules football. And that was what I played from the age of around about 13 or 14. I started playing football right up until the age of 18.
So it sounds like your family and the whole circle of friends that you had were all kind of sporty people. Is that true?
Absolutely, yeah. I grew up with a very sporty, in a very sporty family. My mum was a very good tennis player. My dad played district cricket, and he was always really, 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 really good cricketer. He knows a lot about cricket history. He was very accomplished, but also a very humble guy. So he didn't really talk a lot about his feats, but I would often see and speak to people when I played cricket. I was never much of a cricketer, but a lot of people said, "Oh, yeah, we know your old man. He used to play. He was very, very good," and everyone would always talk about how good Dad was. That was his sport. Never really had the patience for cricket myself. You only get one chance with cricket, so that was always the biggest problem. I'd always go out too early.
You know, I'm not going to talk to you about cricket because it's a bad place for an Englishman to go when he's speaking to an Aussie. I'm just not going to speak about it. Totally, but honest. I mean, I had the pleasure of visiting Melbourne, two or three years ago.
Yep.
And I just love the place. It seemed like a really vibrant city, lots going on. So what did a normal weekend look like for you when you were in your teens, let's say?
Oh, just socialising, but also one of the things that we always did was I still remember hours and hours and hours spent down the park, just kicking the footy, and whether even soccer as well. I had a few mates that were, I grew up with a lot of Greeks. There's a lot of big Greek community in Melbourne. So we'd go down and kick the ball, and it wasn't really anything structured. It was just mucking around, but it was a way to get rid of a bit of energy and socialise with your friends as well. That was what a normal afternoon, an afternoon that I considered to be very, very fulfilling, was just spending time with your mates, playing sport of any variety, tennis, soccer, cricket, football, whatever it might be. It was always outdoors. I was definitely an outdoors type of kid. The only rule in my household was to be home before it got dark, and that's how it was. So I would use up every minute that I had and go home and reluctantly do homework when it got a little bit dark after dinner.
Perfect. And tell me, can you remember what you first wanted to do when you left school? What first wanted to do for a living, that is, when you left school?
So I was enrolled when I left school at the age of, year 2000 I left school. And I was enrolled I had that year where I was still, toing and froing as to what I wanted to do and what I wanted to pursue in terms of study. And that year I played football, I had a part-time job, and I sort of got back into gear, and towards the end of the year I'd enrolled to do a digital animation course, which was around the time when, you know, all those movies like Toy Story had come out, and there was a big, those sorts of things really interested me, and I think that was something that struck my fancy, and I enrolled to do a course at JMC Academy, and that was due to start in 2002. So it was the 2001 year where I was sort of in between, and 2002, early 2002 was the start of the course.
And obviously, we've talked a little bit about your football, but this digital animation, is that something that you had a kind of a passion for, or was it just something like, this is the thing to do next?
Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know, it's a really difficult thing. I speak a lot to students, and I think it's almost an unfair question expecting someone at that age, when you are going through so many changes, to decide what they're going to be doing for the rest of their life. So I don't think it was something where I thought, that is my calling. Digital animation is my calling. It was something that, it certainly interested me, but I wasn't, hell-bent on it, on becoming, on choosing that as my profession. It was something that I needed to do something. That was something that I read about I looked into, and I decided, okay, that's a good place to start. And that's kind of how it came about. But whether I could tell you without a shadow of a doubt that was where my passion lied, I don't think I can do that.
I know you spend a lot of time around kids, especially that sort of age group of kids, and I'll come back to that a little bit later as we chat.
Yep.
But I want to talk to you a little bit now about the meningococcal septicemia that you picked up on a football trip, as far as I'm aware.
Yep.
Where you contacted the disease, and can you walk me through those first few hours and days? Because, I mean, this is a kind of a disease that is very random, and it's many of these kind of diseases are very random. They're not selective, but probably none more so than this disease, which is pretty deadly.
That would be certainly an understatement. Pretty deadly would be. I don't think I could tell you a disease that's more deadly or more or that acts as fast as meningococcal does. You know, right from the moment that you start seeing the symptoms in any patient or anyone that contracts the disease, it's a race against time, and every hour can mean the difference between the loss of limbs or the loss of life. It's a really rare disease. You know, in Australia, if you look at the numbers, it's around about a 1 in a million chance of dying or losing limbs and getting to the point that I got to, and unfortunately for the people that lost their lives to this horrific illness. So it's a super rare disease, and I guess my knowledge of the disease and how I contracted it is very limited, because I'll never know. And I've got to be honest with you, I don't really care to know either. I'm not sure. I'm told that you catch it the same way you catch a cold. I'm also told that you can catch it, you know, being living in close quarters at certain times of the year, it becomes more active. These are sorts of things. I believe 20% of the population carry the germ on the back of their throat, and certain people are susceptible and certain people aren't. That's probably as far as my knowledge goes on the disease. But all I can tell you is, as you said before and as you alluded to, went on this football trip, and I don't remember a thing of it. We were down to Hobart, which is a 45-minute, 50-minute flight from Melbourne, and we spent that time, that four-day period, having fun, letting loose, and really letting our hair down at the end of a pretty long football season. And somewhere along the line of that trip, I got really ill. And everyone just assumed, which is totally understandable, that I was hungover. Of course you would. You know, we're drinking. I'm an 18-year-old kid. The lid really did come off from what I've been told. But somewhere along the line, I got really sick, and we were due to fly back from Hobart from that airport. And I couldn't really lift my head off the ground. I was laying down. I was in a bit of a bad way. And it was decided that someone should call the ambulance, and I should be taken, instead of flying home, I should be taken back to the hospital just to get checked out and see what was going on. And that's what happened. And a teammate, Rowan, he decided to accompany me. We went back to the hospital. I presented. I had all the symptoms, the stiff neck, the rash, a high fever. I was sensitive to light. All these sorts of things were happening, and I was deteriorating at a rapid pace. And that's where they basically, started to go downhill quite rapidly. And then they called my parents, who I could never understand fully what they would have been through and what they would have been thinking. They sent me away as a happy, healthy, fit 18-year-old kid. And then they received a phone call on that Sunday night when they expected me home, saying that I'd been rushed by ambulance back to the hospital and to get down to Hobart because Mike's got about an hour to live. So it's a really confronting illness. What it does to the human body is very hard to look at and to see the damage that it does cause and can cause. I know a lot of people in the same situation me that have lost all their limbs from meningococcal. Sometimes you lose your nose, sometimes you lose, you know, the kidney function, liver failure, bleeds on your brain. It can just be the most horrific circumstances, and that's the extent of what I know about it from a medical perspective. But I was very, very lucky to still be here, and very, very lucky the fact that I still have my hands and I can still do everything and live a really fulfilling life in spite of those circumstances.
Can I just jump in a little bit here? Because I mean, I'm going to use this term so-called hangover, because obviously that's what your mates thought it was at first, understandably. So what kind of time frame are we talking about here from when they thought, hey, Mike's hungover, he's had one too many, until the point where they think, this is something that we're not really sure what it is? What kind of time frame are we talking about? Are we talking about minutes or hours? Or?
It does act very, very swiftly, and the hours of, I guess, not picking it up in time can mean the difference, as I said before, of either dying or losing limbs or losing the function of your kidneys or liver or whatever it might be. So time is really of the essence, the moment that you pick it up or detect the illness, the onset of the illness.
And you said that your family were given a very, very sobering prognosis about your prospects of recovery. And now, having successfully survived and, dare I say, thrived, have you discussed the dark times that you had with your family and that they had? And do you know what was going through their minds?
No. I don't think I'll ever know, because I was on my side of the fence. And I've got to say, as someone who speaks for a living and gets out and I relay my side of the story, one of the things that I can't do, Tony, is I can't really talk about it from their perspective, because I get quite emotional talking about that, because inadvertently I put them through the same thing that I was. You know, I've got the most amazing family, but contracting the disease and going through that, we all had to jump on board. It wasn't just me that went through this horrific illness, this horrific experience. It was all of us as a unit. So I can't fully understand what that must have been like, because there were times where they would have been going through indescribable pain in terms of having to sign consent forms to allow the amputation of my right leg and half of my foot and my fingers and my nose and these sorts of things. They had to be signing these waivers and consent forms saying it was okay to do it, otherwise I would have died. But imagine making that decision for an 18-year-old kid, sporty, my legs and my physical body and sport was my life at that point in time, and then they're having to make these horrific decisions which would inevitably turn it into a situation where I'd be disabled for the rest of my life. And I guess that's not a question that I can answer, or even the fact that I've just written a book which is coming out in July, and I've even got their perspectives in the book, because I can't really comment, because at this point I was put into a coma and it lasted for 5.5 weeks where I was unconscious, until the point when I was transferred back to the Alfred Hospital, and that's when I woke up, and I guess that's when my battle began, when I could really gradually wake up and start to get an idea and try and get my head around about the magnitude of what had happened to me. As I said, very gradual process, but that's when I sort of had to take the reins, and I had to really fight, not just for my sake, but for theirs as well. You know, they were just such an incredible support. They used to come in and out of the hospital. My brother was going through all sorts as well. He had the birth of his first child. My sister was incredibly brave and incredibly supportive as well. She would be same thing. It was really a situation of all hands on deck, and something that I'll never forget and I'll be forever grateful for.
And you've got this really extremely positive outlook now. Has it always been like this? Was this like, were you like this when you were a 12-year-old, 13-year-old kid? Is it part of your DNA?
I believe it is. I'd be lying if I said that I've been optimistic and positive and hopeful right throughout. That'd be a lie. There's been terribly dark days, and you know, I certainly limit those, and I've learned ways to cope and be resilient on an ongoing basis, and being resilient and building resilient behaviour into my life for the long term, because I understand that, you know, there are times in anyone's life where we have ups and downs, and certainly early stages when there was a lot of questions that I couldn't possibly answer, and there were a lot of unknowns at that point as to how my life was going to proceed and about how I was going to possibly recover from there. You know, it seemed impossible because, you know, my goals and the things that I was striving for was being able to sit up on the side of the bed for longer than about 10 seconds without throwing up. You know, that was a real mountain to climb at that time. So these long-term things, how am I going to build my life? How am I going to get back to any level of normality from those dark days, from that rock bottom period, was almost invisible at that point in time. So there were terribly dark days, but we used, as a family, and I think even now, we use humor and we use, you know, our love for one another to really stay upbeat, stay motivated, and we all have an emphasis on the positives and on the fact that I can still do just about everything I did before, and that's how I've approached it. You know, being so optimistic as a kid, that definitely helped. I remember waking up, and despite everything that had happened, all I could think about, I still remember saying things like, well, at least I can still, and then I'd say something else on the end of that sentence. So I'm thinking about the optimistic side of things rather than starting a sentence with, well, look, I'm never going to do, and then finish that one off, if that makes sense. You know, I always had a preference to look at the positives as opposed to the negatives, and I think that's always helped us right the way through. But again, just to reiterate, I don't think I'd be being truthful if I said that there weren't those days where you don't feel like getting out of bed and, you know, the pain does get to you and the unfairness of it all weighs on your mind. I think I wouldn't be human if I didn't have those days, and I think we all have those days. So I'm certainly don't claim to be superhuman. You know, there's days now and times where, you know, you do have your dark moments and everything, but I certainly know and I've learned and I've developed ways to limit those times.
It seems to me that you use mini goals, because you talked about sitting on the edge of the bed there for 10 seconds, and that would, I guess then that became a goal to sit there for 20 seconds. I don't know if that was the case. And it certainly seemed like you got a number of hurdles that you had to navigate on the road to recovery.
Yeah, look, you know, well, I remember one of the things I remember thinking about was, well, now football's off the cards. Because it was a lot to me. I love football. I look forward to that. Now football, contact sport, that's probably going to be a stretch, you know, if I'm thinking about that in hospital. So I remember thinking like, oh, you know, one day I might be able to play golf again. That became a bit of a goal. But in hospital, you're absolutely right. It was just one thing to the next. You know, in those early days, it was a case of, am I going to survive? Because I had setbacks with infections and these sorts of things, and it was a case of one step forward, two steps back. They'd come in and say I'd be able to leave the ICU department in a week, and then a week would pass and they say, no, we'll have to keep you in here for another 2.5 weeks because we're a little bit worried about X, Y, and Z. You know, these sorts of things were happening. So, you know, if I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself about these large goals, well, you know, I can't wait to get back and start walking and living my life and studying again and reconnecting socially and going out and finding a girlfriend or whatever it might be. If I start thinking about those goals that were seemingly impossible at that period of time, it would have been very demotivating for me. So it was just a case of, okay, let's keep things really simple. Let's try and last today and then 2 days from now and then a week from now, and trying to get a little bit stronger or try and put a little bit more weight back on or try and keep food down once I was starting to eat again. These small goals then turn into larger goals, and it was a step-by-step process to recapturing what I would consider to be a quality life that I'm pretty proud to be living these days.
Right, and obviously there's the physical side of what you've had to, how you've had to recover.
Yeah.
But clearly there must also have been some mental and emotional baggage that you've had to deal with as well throughout that time.
Yes, certainly. I don't think anyone who's been through anything physically traumatic will say that I believe without a doubt that they would say the emotional side of things is equally as hard to deal with. Just the fact that you can't move quickly under your own steam can be a really debilitating thing. And from someone that's used to doing that, just from a fight or flight perspective, you know, not being able to escape danger. Or do you know what I mean? It's that kind of that feeling of being incapacitated, being disabled, was very confronting for someone that I guess I relied so heavily on my physical ability. And that was just part of my life. That's always what I knew. So, you know, managing those physical ailments that I've now picked up and being an amputee, a double amputee, if you will, that was really, really tough from a mental perspective, and just feeling like feeling useful, I guess, would be a good term, because at that period of time in hospital, I felt very helpless. I felt very useless, and I felt, you know, it was a case of, you know, you do have those thoughts from a, especially a young man, you're being attracted to girls and things like that. You know, there was things going in my head. Well, who would ever want to be with someone with no legs? And things like that would be running through my head. So, picking up ways to cope with that was as equally as hard as dealing with the physical side of things. You know, picking up good mental habits and mental processes for dealing with those darker times was something that came in time, and something that I had to pay equal attention to. As much time to those sorts of things as you do as a physical side as well.
So you've got therapists that are helping you. Yeah, you're in hospital, so you've got therapists that are helping you physically.
Yep.
I assume that you've got people that you can talk to on the mental and the emotional side. But how are you helping yourself as well? I mean, I know what I'm going to say now sounds a bit crazy, but are you picking up a book? Are you reading something about developing, you know, good mental habits? Are you speaking to therapists? No, are you speaking to mentors? What's going on? How's it work?
The first 6 months, because my brain was affected too. So I had 3 bleeds in the brain during the initial illness, where they were telling my parents that there could be a good chance when I woke up that I would have brain damage. Oddly enough, I remember in hospital, they'd hold up the mirror. I used to sweat down one side of my face only, which was crazy because I had paralysis and one half of my body. So there was all these things that were going on. So I guess picking up a book in that first 6 months to a year to 2 years even became really difficult, because I had a lot of trouble with concentration. I had a lot of trouble sticking to things. Even watching a TV program, I remember getting bored and just switching off and wanting to sort of either sleep or rest or just not do anything. So I guess those, you know, in terms of mentors, I remember right the way through the Alfred stage, which is the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne, before I went to rehab and started, you know, mixing with other amputees, I did have social workers, I did have occupational therapists, I did have other doctors, I did have all these people, and they were trying to tell me and trying to prepare me for what the future might hold. My family were definitely my mum, my dad, my brother, my sister. I definitely lent on them more than I would say a social worker or a counsellor or a psych at that point. So that's what we kind of did as a family. We banded together. Then when I went to Caulfield, I remember I really developed some amazing friendships. So Caulfield was where I did all my rehabilitation with other amputees. And I found that having that connection with people that had been there, experienced the same thing I had, and developing a friendship and being able to sort of lighten the situation in such dark times was very beneficial. And it was so beneficial to the point where I would say that I would give in all the time, all the energy and all the effort speaking to social workers, counsellors, OTs away just for a little bit of time with someone who had been through the same thing. That doesn't mean to say that it's not there and it's not useful, but for me and my coping mechanisms and my coping abilities, I really did start to thrive and start to be buoyed and be more positive when I'd met other amputees that were walking around and getting on with things that have been through something similar in their lives.
So this kind of sharing of experience was really useful.
Yes, and I still do that today,
And you do it the other way as well now, because you've been sharing your experience with other amputees, but now you're sharing your life story and your life lessons with people all over Australia. So tell me a little bit about what made you want to share your story with others.
Yeah, it's been a long process. So I guess I've always thought, I've been now a volunteer for a great charity in Australia called Limbs for Life, which was started by a very close friend of mine, Melissa Noonan, but it was started in 2004, I believe. And I've been part of the peer support program with that. Now, the reason I'm so passionate about getting involved with Limbs for Life and being a support to other amputees, particularly young amputees and amputees that suffer traumatic accidents or illnesses like I did, is because there was nothing like that in my time in hospital. And I reckon I would have benefited so greatly just to have someone walk into that hospital room when I was at the Alfred, just so that you get a bit of perspective about what's possible following that illness. Because like I said before, all these question marks and unknowns were just, there were so many of them. And it would have just been dispelled in an instant if someone had walked in that was a double amputee like myself and in a similar situation to me where I could have gone, wow, that would have been really motivational, I believe. So that's the reason that I choose to donate my time and help out amputees, because I understand how tough that time can be for anyone that goes through that. Losing a limb is a very, very traumatic experience for any human being. And the more support and the more help we can get during that time, the better. So that's where my involvement with that counselling side of things started. And then when I sold, I was in the fitness industry for a while, sold out of the fitness industry around about 2010. And I was later than that, sorry, it was around about 2012. And after we sold that business, I started to ask these questions about what I wanted to do then and move on, what industry, what was I passionate about. And it came down to that dealing with humans, human side of things, that human-to-human interaction. So I started to study. I went back to study and I did. I studied counselling and I got qualifications and I worked out how to communicate better on a one-on-one basis. That helped me with the counselling work, I guess you could say, with Limbs for Life. But then I also met someone who posed the question to me one day. They said, you know, Mike, you're always been really positive, really upbeat. Why don't you share your story and inspire others? And, you know, a speaking sense, why don't you go and do some motivational speaking? And I thought, oh, it's never something that I've ever considered. And I guess it's because I'm always, something that I struggle with is I've always been fairly private. I'm certainly not a shy person and I don't have a problem with getting up in front of people, but I don't feel like what I've done or achieved in my life to be that inspirational. I've never really felt that. But if people choose to be inspired by that, then that's fantastic. You know, I'm not going to say that that's not a good thing. So I decided to look into that a little bit more. And I remember going to a school and my first introduction to speaking was I was asked to go and present to a group of students for around 45 minutes, and I'd never spoken in front of a group of people before in my entire life. And I thought, okay, that should be pretty easy. I'll just get up there and I'll tell a bit about my story and it should be fine. And I remember I had all these grand plans and I had a lot of stuff written down and key points and everything like that. I got up in front of this group of about 150 students and I burned through my material in about 5 minutes and I had nothing else to say. And it was a really tough moment because I'm like, what do I do now? You know, I've run out of ideas and I was umming and ahhing and I threw it to the audience to ask them if they had any questions and it was just a disaster. And I thought to myself, wow, there's a hell of a lot more to this public speaking thing than I imagined. So I realised I needed some training and one thing led to another and I got in touch with a guy in Sydney who provided public speaking training and I got stuck into developing a better skill set around the art of public speaking and delivering a message not to benefit anyone but the people listening. So it's about providing value so that people can take something that I can package up, deliver to them, and then they can implement that in their life, and I'm creating value that way through a pretty horrific circumstance. That's how it sort of came about in terms of the sharing of the story. And I also do a little bit of coaching now. As I said, I've just written a book and I'm starting to develop programs and working with other inspiring people and collaborating with some of the most amazing people that you can ever meet. So it's been a really interesting path, at times challenging, but I'm not one to shy away from a challenge and I do take it very seriously. And I think that if you can benefit others and if people can learn from something that you've been through in a positive way and help themselves in their own lives, then I guess it's certainly a noble endeavour and something that I take, as I said, pretty seriously.
Yeah, you're not only sharing with amputees, you're sharing with lots of shall we call them school kids.
Yeah.
And that might be too broad an umbrella by saying school kids, but you've got a couple of key messages that you promote, and one of them I saw was prepare, survive and thrive.
Yep.
So can you give me a snapshot of how that message resonates with your audiences?
Yeah, look, it's that one is a little bit of an older message, and it's something that I started speaking about, and I was thinking about, you know, in terms of resilience. At the end of the day, I speak about resilience. That's the underlying theme, and I also talk about how to build resilience into your day-to-day life in case something happens. Not in case, but so that you are more equipped to deal with whatever comes your way in life, because we all know that life is full of ups and downs, and sometimes you don't really know, and we can never really predict what's around the corner. Like when I was 18, I didn't expect to be in a hospital bed, unable to move, with a click of your fingers, basically. So I was thinking about what enabled me to get through that time in such a positive way, and then I put that down to three key behaviors, and that's what I deliver in terms of prepare, survive, thrive. That was where that message came from. And one of the key points within that was around this idea of amputating dead weight, and that went back to this decision to get rid of a leg 8 years after the initial illness. So I wasn't always a double amputee. I didn't always have two legs taken off below the knees. Originally, it was just one leg below the knee, and halfway through the foot was taken off. So I had a guillotine chop, they called it, through the arch of the foot. And I kept this leg for 9 years, and I used to dress it every second day, and I used to have all these troubles associated with it. It would break down. I'd spend 3 days in bed waiting for it to heal, and then I'd be back up and it'd break down again. And it was this vicious cycle that I found myself in, and something that was holding me back from living the very best life I could possibly live. So the message of amputating dead weight, once I began speaking, which was 4 years after electing to have surgery on that leg, really was resonating with everyone that I'd spoken to. So I went down this path where people would think about their lives in the broad spectrum, work out what is in their life that's currently not serving them. And then it's a very challenging message, because if I'm talking to an audience and saying, you know, I actually had elective surgery to remove the thing in my life that was holding me back. I decided to amputate my last remaining leg in order to improve my life and find a life of greater freedom, it can be pretty confronting and challenging for people to call them out on why we sometimes leave things in our life when we know they're not good for us. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You're speaking a message here that it's something that I have a lot of empathy with, but yes, please carry on.
Yeah, so that's where that message, as I said, I had three key messages under prepare, survive, thrive, and they were all resilient building behaviour. And that one was the one that was really capturing the audience's attention, and people were coming up to me, goes, I love that idea of cutting the dead wood or ditching the dead weight, or, you know, they'd come up and they'd really resonate with that one. So I decided to put all my focus and energy and attention into that message, because I believe it can be really, really powerful, and it's something that I still do now. It doesn't mean that you have to obviously chop any body parts off or anything like that. Yeah. That's certainly not what we're saying, but it's about getting real with your life. It's about being honest with yourself and understanding that, hey, listen, just because we have accepted something in our life at an earlier time, if it's no longer serving us, perhaps it's time to update and optimize that area of our life. Perhaps it's time to leave it behind, and it's the best way that we can learn, we can grow, is to leave things behind sometimes, because it can be pretty heavy dragging certain things in the future with us all the time. So, yeah, that's where the message stems from.
I think it's a fantastic message as well, and I love the idea, and it's something that I've used a little bit myself. Nothing to do with chopping off body parts, I can assure you.
Yep, yep.
But if it doesn't serve you, why then carry it?
Yes.
And, you know, you see people that have got these massive collections of you know, old magazines or whatever it is, and
yeah,
you know, they have to move them from house to house, and it's just a drain on their mentality, and,
yep,
and you know, why do you do that? And it's the same, I guess, with some friends that they carry that perhaps don't serve them anymore. And when I say serve them, that sounds really bad, but
there's no joy in that
In that relationship anymore.
I agree, and it's funny how a lot of people, I agree, like, there's, you know, decluttering your life can be a really liberating experience too. And if you're talking about friendships, you know, a lot of people say, they go, oh, you know, what if I've got a friend that I don't like, and you know, and these sorts of things. I'm like, no, it's not about saying, going up to your friend and saying, you know what, that's it, we're not friends anymore, you're out of my life. Sometimes the dead weight can be the way that the interactions with that friend might be. So what we tend to do sometimes is we just ignore that and we put up with it, and then we whinge to other people about what that relationship is doing to you in your mood, and how that person has become maybe a bit of a downer, or, you know, you hear those sorts of things. So my advice would be, the dead weight isn't necessarily the friendship. It might be the way that the friendship has gone and the path that it's gone down. So perhaps amputating the dead weight might be having a really tough conversation with that friend and talking about your feelings, as opposed to just letting things totter along as they are and getting to a point where it does blow up and it does become a crisis.
Yeah, it's powerful, powerful, powerful stuff. You also talk about three steps to break out of a comparison funk, and that's to use your terminology, comparison funk. And, yep. And these three are: be selfish, number one, two, quit comparing, and three, carve your own path.
Yep.
So can you give us a little bit more meat on the bones on these concepts?
You have actually caught me out here. That's a blog that I've written a long time ago, but I can only comment I haven't actually, that was quite a while back. But to answer your question, being selfish, number one, that's something that I still stick to, because one of the most selfish things we can do is just to continue on down the road and not give 100% of ourselves to our loved ones. So sometimes, in order to give the very best of ourselves, we need to put a little bit of time and effort into ourselves and be a little bit more selfish. Now, what I mean by that is, when I decided to amputate my left leg, I guess a lot of that stemmed from the fact that I remember my mindset and the way my life had become, and everything that was associated with that leg, such as higher pain levels, less tolerance, you know, mood swings would be up and down. I realized quickly that it was starting to affect all areas of my life, my work life, my family life, my relationships, these sorts of things. And everything was really affected by that. So in order to give more of myself and give more of a quality output to the ones that I cared about, my family, my loved ones, the most, I had to be selfish, and I had to make a decision about my life and spend a bit of time getting myself right so that I could be better for others. So that's what that, I guess, in essence means, that thing about being selfish in order to be selfless. Comparing, that's something I always live by too, because one of the things that you can get into trouble with, and from very early on, was sometimes you can't help it. It's totally normal to compare. But instead of comparing, it's order to strive to be, you know, as successful or as well off, or whatever it might be, whatever you want to strive to achieve. Comparing to other people that have different skill sets, or comparing to people that have different physical abilities or physical attributes, can be a really demotivating thing for us. I remember, you know, early days and being in rehab, there was other amputees, I remember, who were running around with their prosthetic legs. Now, I remember there were days when I look at them, and it was very demotivating. It was very hard to see that and thinking to myself, wow, I'm only just sitting up on the side of the bed, and I've only just been cast for my leg. Look how far away I am from doing what they're doing. And that was that can be a little bit demotivating when we do make unfair comparisons, because they were a lot further down the line with their journey. They had an accident. Yeah. They didn't have to deal with all these other health issues. So it was a really unfair comparison that I would make. I mean, sometimes we can't help make those comparisons, and we do want what other people have. I guess that's human nature. But it's being aware that we are comparing is a really important thing. And I think carve your own path is more about not worrying about what other people are doing and staying focused on what you're trying to achieve and not being distracted by other people. And again, that's to a large extent, that is getting into that comparison funk as well. Carving your own path is, I'm very clear on what I want to achieve on any given year, any given month, any given week. And having those set in stone and worrying about what I'm achieving is something that can really help us instead of being distracted by what everyone else is expecting of us.
Yeah, it's really easy to get into comparing, and certainly today, because of course with the advent of social media, etc., everybody's life seems to be perfect.
Correct.
And we know that it's not.
Yeah, and that's the comparison funk that we can get ourselves into is something that I really do speak and stress that in schools too, because like you just hit the nail on the head then, you know, the things that we're delivered on social media are all sugar-coated. And there's very few people. I actually try and seek out people that are, you know, warts and all type people on Instagram or Facebook, or people that aren't afraid to talk about, you know, how, you know, sometimes we do feel not so great in our lives, and there's certainly not, that's not broadcast. The vast majority of stuff that we hear and that we're fed is all the very best of life and how well people are doing and how rich people are and how beautiful people are. And it's not a real reflection of how life is on a day-to-day basis.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, if we go back a couple of generations, then people bought things because that kind of showed who they are and what they're all about and where their status is. And today, of course, that's different because it's a photograph of the food that they're eating in some kind of restaurant, or the football game that they're going to say, look how great my life is. And you're 100% correct. Not everybody's living that life, and certainly not living it 24 hours a day, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
So I just the last thing before we go on to your golf, because I really want to talk to you a little bit about your golf as well, but just the last part about sort of this re-engaging with your life. So you got out of hospital. And what were the first adjustments that you had to make to your life in order to be able to function as you do?
Oh, that's a tough one. It's quite a long time ago now. And the adjustments that I made were just, it was just such a step-by-step, small step process. But I've got to be honest, I didn't really get back to any level of, I don't like saying the word normality, but independence would be, you know, a level of independence where I was at. I guess the biggest step of was driving again, you know, just being able to get in the car finally after I had a leg on and I'd crutch around a lot and I had this booty on my left foot type thing. But doing those small human little things, being able to go down and sit at the beach or to get a coffee or that independent side of things, that was a real gradual thing. And I would say I wasn't fully independent. It would have taken a couple of years at least, two and a half years, three years even. And that's when I really started to, you know, put a little bit of weight back on. I've always been very, very thin. But at my worst, I was probably down to around about 50 kilos in hospital from 80. So it took such a long time to get back to feeling good. You know, I just felt that my body had been, you know, through hell and back, and it was going to take time to recuperate and to heal. And to, as
and
I said,
needed that time.
Yeah, it did. Absolutely. You know, it wasn't going to be a quick process. So it was having faith that things were constantly getting better, no matter how slowly that was.
And to talk to you now about your golf, so you're obviously pretty active, and the golf that you play would grace any golf course in the world. You're a good player. So how has the game helped you along the road to recovery?
Oh, immensely. I haven't been playing competition golf since 2014 was my first experience, and that was at the World Disabled Golf Championships. Up until that point, I used golf purely as a therapeutic thing. I'd play for fun. I got down to a good level of golf. I had to reteach myself not once but twice, given that I had my left leg off in 9 years on. It was a big bit of an adjustment with my balance. But I've got to be honest, I don't know whether I'd be the same person I am today without golf. It's the most incredible thing to have something that when you are going to sleep at night and you know you're playing the next day, that you have that excitement in your bones. You know, you can't sleep. You know, you, if you're playing a really good golf course, it still to this day excites me to be able to get out there, to be able to switch my phone off and be just in nature doing something that I love, and being outdoors with people that I enjoy spending time with for 5 hours. It's an incredible thing, and I definitely credit that with being a big part of my recovery and my rehabilitation throughout the years.
And have you had any coach that's helped you to reach your potential, or has it really been yourself that's done this?
No. I've definitely had a coach. I've got a very close friend of mine, Christian Hamilton, who works for Golf Australia, who's the National Inclusion Officer. I think he's title.
It's a long title he's got, isn't it?
Do you know Christian? You obviously know Christian.
Actually, if you put the title of Christian, sort of vertical, it'd probably be taller than Christian.
I reckon it would be, yeah. I think, let's be honest, Tony, I'm taller than Christian with my legs off, I think. So he's only a little fella, but he's got a big heart, and he's one of the best blokes you'd be lucky enough to, you know, to meet in your life. He's a fantastic fellow, and he's taught me a great deal about golf and about life. We travelled to Japan together in 2014, and we've been thick as thieves ever since. And he does great things for golf in Australia, not just for amps, but for, you know, any disability category. He's doing some enormous work behind the scenes to get disabled golf in Australia really recognised and really part of the agenda for Golf Australia and Golf Vic. And I couldn't be happier to call him my friend. And he's been a very, very big influence on me. And he's helped me out a hell of a lot with my my golf over the years too.
No, I'm very privileged to know Christian, and I think he, as you've said, he's doing some fantastic work. He really is, and he's got a heart of gold.
He does.
And he's a smart guy. He's putting some really good things together down there, and we're certainly beginning to have a really good relationship on an institutional basis with Golf Australia through Christian and through Stephen Pitt, who's involved with Golf Australia. And you know, Christian is a really good guy. So, but tell me a little bit now about any of the specific shots that, as a result of your disability, that you find particularly difficult.
Oh, stance. That's all I can say. As a double amputee, I get my feet into all sorts of weird and wonderful positions. Just because it's just about getting parallel to the ground. That's all it is. Yeah. So you can be. I don't have ankles, so that's probably the biggest challenge is stances, I think. Other than that, I generally transition quite well. I work hard on my core at the gym, that I, you know, all the generation of power comes from my hips and my core, and I'm able to transfer my weight quite well. But definitely, without a doubt, stances, it's a bit hit and miss. You know, if you're on a slope of some kind, trying to get yourself parallel, you can always, you know, screw one to the left or the right, and it gets pretty annoying. So it's that inconsistency that you really have to battle with. But that just comes in time. And hey, look, we don't hit a great shot every time, do we?
Exactly. And you've worked in the fitness industry. You mentioned it earlier. So I guess you're a pretty active gym goer even today.
Yeah, well, the less I do, I've learned from experience and for over a long period of time, the less I do, the more pain I'm in. That's as simple as that. So it's a case of move it or lose it. I like to stay as active as I can and go to the gym, work on my lower back, my upper back as well, making sure that my posture is as good as it can be, even though I'm tall and got a big frame. It's easy to slouch sometimes, and I always know that as soon as that pain starts to creep in, it's because I'm not doing enough. And it's a really good motivator because it helps me to stay fit, healthy, active, and as agile as I can be.
What have you learned about yourself by playing golf?
I found over the years that I've become a lot more level-headed. I don't really I do a lot of internal bashing. I've got friends that can throw clubs and these sorts of things and get angry. It's pretty rare that you'll see me get upset in a visible sense on the golf course. I do a lot of internal assessing and internal processing, you know, if I've done something wrong, but I quickly snap out of that, as I know you could. And I think over time, when I was younger, I was a bit of a hothead and I'd get upset pretty quickly. And now I've certainly mellowed out, and I'm more of a calm, I have more of a calm demeanor on the course these days. So that's something that really helps me.
And you mentioned earlier that you still feel the excitement of waking up tomorrow morning and going out and playing. But what does golf really mean to you?
It's a passion that I still hold very dear, and I take it probably even a little bit too seriously sometimes. I find that it's a never-ending quest to get better because I always say the moment you think you're on top of your game, you're not. It's very easy to go out there and shoot. It happened the other day in the Australian Amputee Championships. I had a fantastic round one. I shot 76 and I was equal second with the eventual winner. And then the next day I came out and it was a real internal struggle and I had 88. Now that is horrific in comparison to my first day, but it just goes to show when you're, you know, it does humble you. It has this ability to put you back in your place. And I think that's what attracts me. That's what I really like about it. It's that challenge. It's never any challenge to get better and to improve.
Just the nature of the game.
Yeah.
That's the way it is.
Yep.
Any heroes or role models that you've looked to as you've progressed throughout your career as a golfer?
Not particularly. I love watching golf. I just admire them. And I got to play with Ricky Fowler. A big thank you to the Cobra Puma guys, who I'm an ambassador for. They teed up a game with Ricky at the World Cup. I didn't know about it. I got to the golf course, read the team list, and I thought, Ricky Fowler. I'm like, geez, I remember feeling super nervous and thinking, surely that's a mistake. And I went out there and I got to play, and he was a fantastic fella. And it's just always, it doesn't matter who you play with in terms of professionals, they are just incredible to watch play the game and how good and how accurate and how consistent they are. And, you know, I don't really have anyone in particular. I used to, growing up, I was always a big fan of Tiger Woods, still am. He's just an incredible athlete, an incredible competitor. And that's someone that I always looked up to, yeah, for sure.
And what about any goals or objectives that you've got in golf that you maybe would like to share with us or you'd be prepared to share with us? Do you have any of those?
No, it's just to probably get better. And I think goals and objectives with golf over the next couple of years, I've just become the state president of Amputee Golf Victoria. I really want to see a lot more young people come into the game, amputees, that is, and females as well. I'd love to set it up so that we have a real influx of the next generation of golfers coming through and they can learn from the older guys. You know, I think it's going to put us in a better position in the years to come if we get more of an inclusive situation and we invite people along to come along and try. There's not a heavy focus on doing really, really well and shooting the lights out. It's just about getting out on the course, interacting with other people who have been through similar things and having fun along the way.
Tell me, you've been around long enough now. Tell me about any adjustments that you would make to get more of those people into the game. So in other words, making the game more user-friendly for golfers with disability.
Oh, that's a good question. The only thing I would say in Australia is it's a very expensive game to play. You know, you do meet people and they work and they struggle and, you know, if it's from a financial perspective, perhaps if – maybe that's not the right answer to that question. I don't know. More user-friendly for people with disability.
Just make it
– I've got the perfect thing. How about we fill in all the bunkers, Tony? Does that sound good?
Right.
Just get rid of all the bunkers on every golf course and we're all happy. You know, wheelchair people are happy and amputees don't have to get in and out, don't have to rake them, it'd be fantastic. I don't really know. I think in terms of being inclusive and disability friendly, I think golf courses are quite well set up now. I think a lot of golf courses I play at in Australia, they all have carts. They're starting to roll out. I know there's a lot more paragolfers around different venues around the country and that side of things is really being looked after. And now Christian is pushing this whole agenda where it's really getting people out of the house and onto the golf course in Australia. And, I'm not really sure whether there'd be anything I'd change.
Just a few final questions here, Mike. So is there anything about you that might surprise us?
Anything about me that might surprise you? That's a really good question. I'm not really sure. I love to cook. How about that? I would.
Okay.
That's not.
Are you a good cook?
Surprising. Yeah, I'm not too bad in the kitchen. And we've got this crazy show over here called MKR, and I would really like to maybe apply for that at some time with my sister or my partner Andrea. and maybe go out there and fly the flag for amputees in the kitchen. How about that?
Cool. What's your best dish? If you had to rustle up a dish for us, what would you do?
Japanese. I love Japanese food. It's my favorite food, and I love the simplicity, but also it's just incredibly healthy for you too. So that's definitely something I would say is my favorite.
Well, we'll be looking for you on MKR. MKR, I should say.
My kitchen rules. Yeah.
What's the worst advice that you've ever received, Mike?
The worst advice I have ever received? Oh, that's a good question. I remember being told once not to push myself too hard. because, you know, I don't know whether that was, that came from, I won't mention any names or their occupation. I think that flies in the face of progress, and I don't care what your situation in life is in terms from a physical perspective. If I didn't push myself hard, I wouldn't be where I am today from a physical perspective or a professional perspective. I think that people in those sorts of situations, there's no reason why we can't push ourselves and can't ask more of ourselves. That's probably would be up there. I remember thinking that was a bit of an unusual thing to say.
Yeah, you certainly push yourself to get to where you are, there's no doubt. Just the last question. So if you could magically be with someone who found themselves in a similar situation as yourself just a few years ago,
yep.
What advice would you offer to them?
Okay, so one bit of advice I always talk to the Limbs for Life patients and people that I get to meet is I always say, when it comes to amputations and prosthetics, never ever accept or put up with being uncomfortable. And what I mean by that is prosthetic legs can be just like wearing a pair of your most comfortable shoes. For me anyway, I always find that, you know, I've had legs before that I've worn for 3 hours and I can barely stand up and I'm in incredible amounts of pain. So you go back and you get them fixed. And if they don't work again, you go back, you get them fixed again and again and again and again until they become comfortable. And if all that still fails and they're still uncomfortable, get them to make you some new sockets. So that's something that I don't believe anyone should be suffering wearing sockets that are uncomfortable. There's always a way that you can get them to fit a little bit better and be a little bit more comfortable. So that's definitely some advice that I like to give to people that are amputees, and I think it's some advice that someone gave me very early on, and I'm probably the most annoying patient to my prosthetist, I've got to say, but who cares?
Good advice, and you've got to stand on them, eh?
Cool. Yeah, exactly. I walk away, they don't have to wear them, so by God, I'll be comfortable.
Mike, it's been fantastic to speak to you. It's been wonderful to listen to your story and to hear your positivity, which just shines through.
Thanks, Tony.
And I think that the resilience that you mentioned, and you said, I think earlier, that it underpins everything. It's clear that you've got that in bucket loads, or you've developed it in bucket loads. And I'm so proud of you just to go out there and share your message to as many people as you do. So good on you and keep doing it.
Thank you so much.
If people wanted to reach you, how could they? I wanted to talk to you about one more thing. Which is about your book. I made a note of it here and I almost missed it.
But
you've got a book coming out, you said, in July. What's that going to be about, and how can we get one?
It stems from the Amputate Deadweight message. That's not what the book could be called. I got picked up by a publishing house, Murdoch Press, late last year, which was fantastic news, and they've taken on board, obviously, the editing and the photos and all the rest of it. It's the full kit and caboodle. And basically, it's coming out in July this year, and it's called Ditch the Dead Weight, and it talks about, like we were talking before, about not settling for second best in our lives. It's about actively making strong decisions in order to improve your life and to cut free those things that we drag forward in our lives that we don't necessarily need or that no longer serve us. So that's what the gist of the book is about. And it's not just for amputees. It's not for people with disabilities. It's for everybody in this world. And it can apply to it can apply to everyone in many ways, and it's something that I still do in my life and apply the same principles in the book to my life in order to improve it, and it helps a hell of a lot with growth.
Great. Well, I'll put that on my wish list, and I'll be looking for it. I assume it'll be coming out on Amazon or something like that. We'll be able to get it, I guess. But if not, I'm sure you'll be able to tell us where we can get it from.
Absolutely.
So just go back to the question I mentioned is, if people like to reach you, how can they find you, Mike?
On the internet, www.mikerolls.com.au, and on Instagram as well. Just type in Mike Rolls. I'm sure I'll pop up there somewhere. And I'm always happy to speak to anyone and everyone around the world, or anyone that might have some questions about something in particular or some pathways they want to pursue golf in, particularly in Australia. I can certainly help out there, and I'd love to get more people involved in the game and really promote it for a not just a physical perspective, but from a rehabilitation and a lifestyle benefit. The benefits it can have can be so wonderful for people in similar situations to myself.
Great. Well, Mike, I know now it's probably almost approaching dinner time for you, so I'm going to let you go and make some Japanese food.
I just got the call from my brother that it's ready. He's over having dinner with us now, so yeah, I do need to run. But it's been fantastic talking to you, Tony, and I just wanted to commend you on being so thorough with everything so far, and the brief that you've sent through and everything. You've been nothing but completely professional throughout the whole process, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, Mike.
This was an Edgar Player story supported by Ping, helping golfers to play their best. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Stay tuned for the next Edgar podcast. Ping. Play your best.